Blog Talk Radio.
Well, France has spoken in the first round, and they've decided that they want a person who's brand new to politics, has been in politics for about a year, from the center, and somebody from the right. So they say that the lady on the right doesn't really have much of a chance. But they said that about, of course, about Trump. It's another move in Europe for a change. And the two consensus candidates lost. And so this has not been seen for a long time, if ever, in the history of France. And here is a little bit on this election from Financial Times.
The results are in from the first round of voting, and the next French president will be either an independent centrist politician or the leader of the far-right Front National. Emmanuel Macron will go head-to-head with Marine Le Pen in the second round on May the 7th, pitting against each other two politicians with diametrically opposed visions for France and its place in the world. French voters face a clear choice. Mr. Macron's embrace of globalization, economic modernization, and European integration, or Ms. Le Pen's call for protectionism, the return of national borders, and withdrawal from the euro. The vote was also an unmistakable rejection of the status quo. France's established center-right and socialist parties have held the presidency between them for more than 50 years.
En une année, nous avons changé le visage de la vie politique française.
Mr. Macron, a relative political novice, who has never held elected office, came out on top with just under 24% of the vote. Ms. Le Pen was in second place on over 21%, and most of the votes have now been counted.
Ce résultat est historique. Il fait reposer sur moi désormais la responsabilité immense de la défense de la nation française, de son unité, de sa sécurité, de sa culture, de sa prospérité et de son indépendance.
Sunday's first round vote turned into a four-way cliffhanger. It followed a tumultuous campaign marked by surprise primary results, corruption allegations, insurgent candidates from the extremes, and a terrorist attack in Paris. Senior figures from the campaigns of the defeated establishment party candidates have thrown their support behind Mr. Macron, while the far-left candidate said he would wait until the final result was confirmed before admitting defeat. That makes Mr. Macron, who only formed his centrist political movement En Marche last year, the firm favorite to be installed in the Élysée Palace. Before that, he was an economic advisor to the current president, François Hollande. Ms. Le Pen will be hoping to go one better than her father, who shocked the French establishment in 2002 when he reached the second round of the presidential election before losing out to Jacques Chirac. Victor Mallet, Financial Times.
All right, so how does that affect us? Well, I think it would affect us quite a bit. If Le Pen got in there, then you could say that there was a movement towards independence. rejection of globalism. And you know what I was thinking is, you know, the Germans are still behind what's her face? Yeah, their leader. And so you must ask why, when Germany has had a lot of problems, nothing like France, but so I happened to meet, and I'm not making this up, a group of rocket scientists over the weekend who were from Europe. One guy was from Sweden. And another couple were from France. And there was a guy from Colombia, the country, who had lived in Germany and some other places. They were all obviously working at White Sands. And we got into a discussion about immigration. And almost at the very beginning, a couple of the guys said, "We're not going to take this," and got up to leave. And I was in somebody's apartment. So the other people said, "Come on, just cool off a little bit." And so we proceeded to talk about it. And the guy from Germany was probably the most adamant that it was the right thing to do to bring in 1 million people from Syria last year. And I said, "Well, what's your purpose?" And he said, "Well, to give these people charity, to give them, they need a place, you know, to show them, you know, so hospitality and mercy and everything." And I said, "Well, do you know anything about Islam? Have you studied Islam or the Sharia law?" And the guy says, "No, I haven't." And I said, "Well, aren't you curious?" And he says, "It doesn't matter." And I was like, "Wow, boy, that's the fury, the self-righteousness and fury of ignorance, you know." Well, here's a little bit more from the French election.
And this is a Fox News alert. The French election has been called, and the result is a runoff between two candidates, far-right populists Marine Le Pen and centrist pro-European Union candidate Emmanuel Macron. The two will face off in that runoff on May 7th, 2 weeks. For analysis, let's go to Greg Paucott. He's in Paris. I mean, Greg, how much of an upset is this? You've got the two political outsiders beat out the two establishment front runners. What's the reaction in France? And then talk about, if you will, how will Marine Le Pen and Emmanuel Macron campaign moving forward?
Absolutely, Arthel. This is big news, a stark choice chosen by the French voters. They have rejected the major parties. They have gone with the outsiders. The projection is still just that. We do not have hard results. But according to the projections from the major pollsters here, Emmanuel Macron, the centrist, moderate independent, will go through to the second round, the runoff in these presidential elections, as well as Marine Le Pen, the firebrand far-right populist. And it will be a stark choice indeed. Marine Le Pen stands for firm borders, a crackdown on immigration, a crackdown on the Muslim population, this to deal with the insecurity, the terrorism that France has faced. She's also very much opposed to much of what France does with the European Union and with the euro currency. She sees the EU as one of the big blocks to the growth here in France. French economy, much stagnation seen here. As for Emmanuel Macron, well, he in fact is pro-EU, pro-European Union and the euro. He is calling for other kinds of reforms to try to get this economy going. And he takes indeed a much more moderate line, a more integralist line concerning Muslims here and in dealing with the terrorism that has struck here. So, in fact, there are two choices, strong choices, that the French people will be making in 2 weeks' time. The latest polls showing that Macron, in fact, will win that second round, the runoff in these presidential elections, and will go forward. But as we all know, Arthel, nothing can be taken for granted in this season of political upsets and concerns. But again, going to the runoff with Macron and Le Pen, the fireworks have just begun. In fact, some fireworks tonight, some clashes here in the city of Paris.
So here's a question. What will happen if there's another terrorist attack or several terrorist attacks? I mean, you know, how could you possibly predict? So anyway, I mentioned, I don't know if you caught the show last week. It was on Friday. I did a segment on Dale Watson, the honky tonk country and Western singer, about his battle with what he described as Satan, which I thought was kind of interesting, you know? So I said I'd play some Watson this week. Here's the first Watson song that I ever got into, The Fugitive, 6:15, 6:16 exactly. And Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450 on KOBE. We'll be right back. And I've got some coming up for you. Well, in the second hour, I want to focus a little bit on Islam and the Crusades. I want to remind people or inform them, if you've never had the opportunity to get into the history of the Crusades, how what we're dealing with now is still kind of a continuation of that. And but this first hour, some news for you, and we'll be back. I'll do a rundown of the headlines for you. 523-1450, we'll be right back.
I'd like to settle down, but they won't let me. A fugitive must be a rolling stone. Down every road there's always one more city. I'm on the run, the highway is my home.
Bob.
Hey, sir. How are you, Kelly?
Bob. What's
you
going
had,
on?
You had a good weekend, I could tell.
What's going on, man?
Well, I was just hoping I could, announce that I'm going to be addressing the county commissioners and the city council. Okay. So.
All right, man. Let me put you on hold, and we'll be right back.
I love you. You make a great president, Kelly.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. All right, so we've got our headlines here, but first we have our early morning call from Bob. What's going on, Bob? You want to?
Yes, sir.
You're going to address
President,
the council.
It's a superb honor to be talking to you, Kelly. Good morning.
Yeah, let me talk while you're talking, Bob. Go for it.
I apologize. The reason that I'm calling you is to let you know that I'll be addressing the county commissioners, Don Anna County Commissioners, on Tuesday. That's tomorrow at 9 a.m. And those people that have Comcast Xfinity will be able to tune in. Also, is the following week, on May the 1st, I'll be addressing the Ken Migashima and the council at 1 o'clock on Comcast Xfinity also. I cannot tell you that I would not be able to do this if it wasn't for you and the people that you know and your staff and the fact that you're here, Kelly. So I thank you. It's going to be successful. I did see Dr. Beth on Friday. I went to a budget meeting. And, you know,
Dr. Who?
Good.
Dr. Who?
Beth.
Doctor.
Mom.
I thought you said.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
I'm sorry. I'm
I think
sorry,
she's from
Bob.
Fort Worth. She's a wonderful lady. She's
Bob.
A really, really good lady, Kelly.
Bob,
okay, I'm sorry.
Keep talking, man. Don't let anybody interrupt you. That's how you get ahead in life. I do appreciate you giving me all the credit for you being able to go forward. I'm not sure exactly how I helped you, but I will take credit for it.
Well, you are a master of ceremonies. You're the one with the voice. You're the one that knows. Nobody, if you don't know, nobody's going to know. So that's the way I see it. Okay, so you're just a great person. I want you to drive safely, the speed limit, but we'll be fine, all right?
All right, but if you, I don't want you to drive the speed limit because there are other options for you, Bob. Including.
You're not the only one. I started my campaign walk over the weekend. I can hardly wait to talk to Juan Vasquez and see if he's enjoying his Juan Valdez coffee from Walmart.
You might want to give him a G.I. Joe action doll and say,
one. J.J. Arm down El Paso? Sure.
One. Okay. All right, Bob. Silly. Great to hear you.
I love you, man. And everybody just said, tell Mike Bob said hello, all right?
All right, man. Take care. Bye-bye. He doesn't realize Mike's been gone for, Mike's been gone for like a year, but Mike's still doing ads, but Mike's no longer working here, which is sad because Mike McKay was pure gold. He was on 101 Gold, but really tremendous individual. All right, we got our Bob report out of the way. Now, I did have a crash and burn at the controls of the computer, but we've righted the ship here. I don't know why it started doing this, but anyway, I've got for you. Let's see if I had to get out of this thing here, but I've got for you. All right, a statement was made by Le Pen's opponent. We have to vote for Macron. That's the only way forward. And frankly, that was said of Donald Trump too, wasn't it? So here's your headlines for you. New political era for France, nationalism versus globalism. Le Pen camp attacks Macron as oligarch's candidate, oligarch ruling family. And so Obama's back, community organizer. You know, it'd be a funny TV show. Remember the show Office? Remember the show Community? Put them together and put a figurehead just like Obama in charge, and how they continually attack the hated president, and how it always blows up in their face. But Obama's back. He's doing the only thing he's probably ever really been comfortable at. I don't think he was comfortable. He might have been comfortable as president, but I don't think he was comfortable in the role of leading the United States. Never got a sense that he was on board 100%. Did you? 523-1450. Trump, Congress and Trump on collision course in government shutdown. That would be weird since the Republicans are the same party as Trump. But unusual meeting with the United Nations Council at White House. And Xi urges restraint on North Korea in phone call, the leader of China. Of course, that helps them. Japan now demanding nuke shelters, purifiers surging for sales. Uber secretly tracking iPhone users after they deleted the app. I just read where there's a set of headphones that track for NSA. Is that nice? Spy chiefs meeting in New Zealand for Five Eyes conference. I would assume the major countries of the old British Empire. And Merkel, that's the lady I was trying to think of her name. Populism continues. I wanted to tell these guys, but I really didn't, because they really threw a fit, and we're going to walk out. That, you know, it is really become very popular to throw a fit and become a baby. I don't know what's going on, but these guys are going to walk out. But I wanted to challenge the German guy, but from what he had said about Islam, he wouldn't have known anything about it. One of the reasons that Germany got into World War II, World War I, World War II, but one of the reasons that they went after the Jews was incidentally related to their theory of law. Now, when the Reformation comes into Europe, challenges the theory of, and there is a kind of a legal revolution in Europe, but it gets stopped in Germany. Germany never goes through a legal revolution. So you've got in Germany the positive law, man-made law, is more powerful than and intellectually has more call to support than the idea of the natural law. So when they came in and when Hitler came in and made a bunch of rule changes, changed the laws, and he made Jews illegal, the Germans, this is the argument anyway, the Germans didn't have the legal sophistication to fight back against that. And so then it made me think about this guy. He was really going to bat for Merkel, and she's been a total disaster, you know. She's like, she's just really has a lot of qualities you wouldn't want in a leader. All right, more Venezuelans struggling in United States as their own country implodes down south. Italian immigrant or migrant crisis, charities colluding with smugglers. Isn't that crazy? Philippines, Duterte said he can be 50 times more brutal than terrorists. Just give me vinegar and salt and I'll eat his liver. Study, regular bedtime stops obesity. And they're talking about breaking up Google. It's become a massive, massive organization. It's a monopoly. Now, for Caitlyn Jenner, who's the first guest on Tucker's show, Caitlyn's old wife is really hating his guts right now because he claimed that he never really wanted to be intimate. And they've made posters around Los Angeles that he's a terrorizing clown. 20 killed in Venezuelan protests. Saudi Arabia named Sun as envoy, signaling that they want to get closer to the United States. And let's see here, a Great Dane, 7 feet long, heavier than a baby elephant. Of course, you have to wonder how big a baby elephant is. It's got to be fairly big, huh? Now, there's some people that are claiming that Fox News is not going to make it, which I find a little bit crazy, but... All right, we've got some local news for you here. And we'll get to that. Kelly O'Connelly, I'm Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. And call in, get your opinion on the record, make a statement, ask a question, challenge me. It's all good. We'll be right back.
A lot of games back in my younger days. And mama, you. Pray my crops would fail.
The claim is that it is not a crazy regime, but a ruthless and reckless one in North Korea. And I mean, I don't know. On a practical level, what the difference is, but this is from the former defense secretary under Bill Clinton. But so what do you guys think is going to happen? I mean, no matter how bad it got between the United States and Russia, there was never ever a sense that we were just going to, you know, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis and we had a lot of other things, but there was never a sense that it was just all going to end. But so I guess we really don't know what's going to happen because we don't know the things that are influencing this case. Who's not crazy? The fat little kid. They say that Trump is exercising restraint and covering North Korea with China and Japan. And I did some military investigation last night, and they've got a 60 submarine Navy. But I saw a picture of one of them. It looked like it was made out of, I don't know how I would describe it. It looks like it was made by a shop class. It literally, the top of the submarine in the center, that thing that sticks up like, I don't know, 30 feet above the rest of it. that looked like it had been welded together by a shop class. It was all kind of different pieces of metal that were welded together and then painted over, so I wouldn't feel too comfortable going downstairs in that. But all right, so let's get on this wall a little bit. Nancy Pelosi has something to state that is very important in her own, speaking of crazy and kind of untethered, check it out. She's probably long overdue for a retirement party, but here we go. Nancy Pelosi.
Coming from a state that might be impacted by a border wall, is there any scenario that you will support or that Democrats will help keep the government open if there is money designated to build the wall?
The Democrats do not support the wall. And I think that the Republicans on the border states do not support the wall. The Republicans have the votes in the House and the Senate and the White House to keep government open. The burden to keep it open is on the Republicans. The wall is, in my view, immoral, expensive, unwise. And when the president says, well, I promised a wall during my campaign, I don't think he said he was going to pass billions of dollars of cost of the wall onto the taxpayer.
Well, let me ask you this, though. The budget director of the United States said, hey, elections have consequences. Republicans are in charge, as you just pointed out. But there are some Democratic spending priorities you want to push for, including to help make sure that while Obamacare is still law, it is fully functioning. What's wrong with giving the president his money for a border wall in exchange for a priority that is not his, keeping Obamacare fully functional and funded? As a priority that's important to you. What's wrong with that kind of horse trading in Washington?
What is wrong with it, that scenario, is the wall. The president talks about how tall it is, who's going to pay for it, and all the rest of that. But you have to understand this part of the country. There's a community with a border going through it. The president, I think, talking about this wall, is expressing a sign of weakness. He's saying, I can't control our borders. I have to build a wall. We certainly would like to. We have a responsibility to control our borders. Building a wall is not an answer, not here or any place.
That's kind of nuts, isn't it? I mean, number one, the guy ran on the wall, but number two, the idea that no wall anywhere, anytime, any place could be an answer, right? I mean, as everybody knows, Obama just built a house about 2 miles away. Or just bought a house about 2 miles away from the White House. And guess what? He put up a very big wall. So, I mean, it's almost like the people that follow the left are so brain damaged that they come up with this stuff, not through any process of logic, but because that's the position that they have to take. Therefore, they take it without any appeal to logic or reasoning. Now here is the question, can we get Mexico to pay for the wall? This is Lou Dobbs from a couple days ago. Lou Dobbs. So, hold on.
You're Rachel Campos Duffy and partner at Maslansky and Partners Lee Carter. And, well, listen, let me start with you, Rachel, the business about the wall. They're doing basically what they promised they would do in the campaign. What's the problem?
Can you repeat that question? I couldn't hear you very well.
Well, they're doing what President Trump said he would do. So I'm going, what's everybody all upset about?
I'll tell you who's upset about this. Democrats, and not for the reasons you think that they're upset about this. They're upset because if you want to win the Hispanic vote, this is the way to do it. Build the wall, bring down illegal border crossings, kick out the bad hombres, the felons, and guess what you have? All the makings of immigration reform, all the things that need to happen before you can get a bipartisan immigration reform. Donald Trump is poised to do the ultimate triangulation, which is bring about immigration reform. And I'm telling you, he won the Reagan Democrats in this last election. If he wins a Hispanic vote, he's up for another reelection. I guarantee you that.
All right. Well, listen, Lee, when it comes to the wall, this does seem to be a campaign promise. Is he doing, like Rachel said, triangulation? Is he managing this whole process right?
Look, I think he is. There's no question, right? This is a campaign promise. It's one of the big issues that he went on. And I think that everybody's expecting this to happen. The question I think that a lot of folks have is, how is he going to pay for it? Because he promised Mexico was going to pay for it. Then we're talking about, we're going to get tax revenue to pay for it. Where is the money going to come from? And I think that's what a lot of the criticism is coming from. I think people are going to be excited to see it happen, especially those traditional Trump supporters who are out there from the beginning saying, this is what we want, this is what we need. And I think people are going to be excited to see the action happening. So the question is, where's the money going to come from? And is it possible for them to get that started by late summer? I think the other thing that people are looking at are these expectations that the administration is setting out. Next week's going to be tax reform. Healthcare is going to get done by this time. We're going to get all this passed by that. There's a lot of expectations being set out there. Really important that he's going to meet them because the markets are waiting to see it happen.
I know where the money's coming
from. But remember, without even having built the wall, we're seeing border crossings down by 70%. Again, I think this is incredible news, not just for everybody who wanted the border secured for terrorist reasons or for labor employment
drugs,
reasons,
whatever.
But also
yeah.
for, yeah, I think this is a real interesting triangulation, a way to win the Hispanic vote, because you can pass immigration reform if you secure the border.
I think a lot of people that are kind of moderate on that whole issue, I think, agree you have to stop the leak before you can even begin to address what do you do with all the people here.
All right. So you get where these guys are coming from on this. I've got some weather for you. 523, 1450 at 643 on AM Las Cruces. Kelly O'Connell. And we'll come back. And I've got a bunch of stories. I've got a story about a doctor who claims that the president is dangerously insane. And I'm just wondering when these people are going to stop with these crazy attacks where they just completely trash their reputations. We'll be back and discuss that.
I need you to tell with just two ways. Outrun the law or spend my life in jail.
This guy, top psychologist, Trump has malignant narcissism, and we've got from the Independent, the UK Independent, also in the Daily Mail, Donald Trump is a dangerous mental illness, says psychiatry expert at Yale conference. Psychiatry experts, more than one, Donald Trump is a dangerous mental illness, is not fit to lead the United States. A group of psychiatrists has warned during the conference at Yale University. Now, I did some research into the leader of this claim. It's Dr. John Gartner, a practicing psychotherapist at Johns Hopkins, and he says, we have an ethical responsibility to warn the public about Donald Trump's dangerous mental illness. He's paranoid, delusional, ethically responsible. They have an ethical responsibility to warn the Americans about the dangers of Trump. Now, members of a group called Duty to Warn. But here's the question. I mean, so I did research on this guy. He's a very big lefty, of course. But when are these people going to stop? I mean, none of these people has examined Trump. So when is this going to end? When are these claims, this idea that the, you know, and there, it came from different angles. From one angle, he colluded with Russia. From another angle, he's a complete joke. You can't take him seriously. Another person, Hillary got more votes. Trump has no authority. Now, from the psychiatric community, and Here's from the notes. There's about 1,000 notes underneath this thing. As a psychiatrist, I again am dumbfounded by colleagues in the U.S. making claims such as these based on what they have observed in the media, incorrect and completely unethical. Unless you have personally assessed someone, preferably over a decent amount of time, it's impossible to make these assumptions. And that was kind of my takeaway from that is, isn't there a duty to examine somebody before you give them a diagnosis? I'm just so flabbergasted by that, but there's no end to it. All right, let's see. Let's take our last break here and then come back and see what else that I have on my list to talk about. And then we're going to get into a little bit of the history of Crusade. 649 Kelly O'Connell AM, Las Cruces AM 1450. Thank goodness it's Monday, huh? Be right back.
I'd like to settle down, but they won't let me. A fugitive must be a rolling stone.
All right, so a little story briefly. PJ Media, are you ready to see Fox disappear? And here's a statement from the Hollywood Reporter that the battle at Fox to get rid of O'Reilly is about something deeper. It's a reflection of greater family and company interests and conflicts. For 86-year-old Rupert Murdoch, Fox News is a key part of his legacy as well as the family's company health. It's the most profitable news outlet ever, $1.5 billion in profits this year, and among the most influential. For James, 44, and Lachlan, 45, the hope is to reshape this legacy, to move Fox away from what they see as its retro Trump-style views towards something nicer and hopefully more profitable. And so there's a battle going on New York Times in the House of Murdoch's son said about an elaborate overhaul. So it shows you once again that the views of people, the religious views, and then the fake views are more important, fake religion, I should say. Fake religion and religious views, liberalism, whatever, is more important than even profits or influence. Here's Maria Bamford. My coworker hates me. Speaking of influence.
Yeah, have you ever had somebody at work who hates you and you can't figure out why? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's scary. I used to have this girlfriend at work. We started out on the wrong foot. I asked her where she was from. She said, Glendale, California. I said, oh, that's supposed to be really nice. She said, yeah, it is. Are we fighting now? Because, girlfriend, I will throw down. And she stopped talking to me, and I kept talking to her. Even though talking to her was like shouting into the wind of an angry desert that shows no mercy even to the benevolent armadillo. Every morning going in there, good morning, Vinette. Hey, I'm heading out for lunch. Can I get you anything? Well, TJF, have a great weekend. And I know she didn't like me personally because she would talk to anybody else about anything.
Hey, Vinette, we got a package here for you.
My cat got out this weekend and she got as far as the front walk and she looks up at me like, what? And I'm like, you know what?
Vinette, why won't you tell me the wonderful cat story? I did get her to talk about me, which was satisfying.
Someone keeps leaving a nude poster of David Hasselhoff in the color copier.
It's me, Annette. It's me.
Someone went in the kitchen and laminated all the cocoa packets together.
Hey again, Annette. Hey again.
Someone is always in the unisex bathroom singing Spanish folk songs.
Se colores, se colores, se hizo los ojos de la primavera. Ay, 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 ay!
All right, somewhat bizarre, but anyway, take you out with a little Dale Watson. We're going to come back and get into a little bit of the crusade. 658 Kelly O'Connell AM Las Cruces. And so France picked two newbies, two parties, or did not choose the leaders from the old parties. And so we've got Macron, who's brand new and is a globalist, and against Marine Le Pen. You know, when it's bad news, you send in a Marine. Marine Le Pen, and she is kind of a Trump, France's Trump. So we'll find out in 2 weeks where they go with that. We'll be right back after a break on the hour. AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523-1450.
Down every road, there's always one more city. I'm on the run, the highway is my home.
Okay, so the first hour we spent talking about France about halfway through the show. Then we switched her up and discussed the wall a little bit and a few other things. And I'm looking at Google News for the headlines, French election, Emmanuel Macron and Marine, sending the Marines Le Pen, fight for the presidency in 2 weeks. And they say Macron has a huge advantage. And there is a battle over the wall, and it's assumed, if you've been kind of watching, it's pretty obvious that the out of principle or a lack of principle, the Democrats are going to oppose everything, every single thing that the Republicans do that Trump does, because I guess if they do that, they can pretend that they're principled, but in the meantime, there's this really weird fight that's broken out in the Democratic Party. The leadership of the Democrats have decided that they're going to open up the door for pro-life Democrats, pro-life people. which is really weird because the one thing that I always knew that the Democratic Party stood for was unlimited abortions. So I think they're dealing with the issue of loss of support and enthusiasm and new blood into the party, and they're going to what they think is a quick fix, which would be to bring in or allow there to be more dissent, so that's going to go anywhere, because it seems like a person who's opposed to abortion would be opposed to a lot of other things that the left is into. But all right, so let's talk a little bit about, and I had mentioned to you, oh, and before I do anything else, in a shocking Washington Post poll that they buried the information in the inside of the poll, they didn't put it in the title, Trump still beats Clinton 43% to 40%. So Clinton has persuaded nobody, and the idea that everybody's given up on Trump, including his supporters, is absolutely nuts. Oh, and there is one other interesting story to throw out to you, which is kind of made contradictory sense when I read it. Aaron Hernandez, the great tight end who later was convicted of murder and put in prison, and then he was charged with another murder, and then he won the other murder case and then killed himself the next couple of days. Aaron Hernandez may have committed murder to cover up secret. They say that he had gotten to know his sister's boyfriend, who was also a semi-professional athlete, and Odin Lloyd. And they say that he went out and killed him because he had found out about Aaron Hernandez's secret, which was that he was bisexual. Now, where's the logic of this? Because he's very macho, covered with tattoos, tough guy, starts fights. I mean, there's a lot of stories, you know. There is a theory out there that homosexuality is not an inborn trait, that it is actually fully a result of environment. And when Aaron Hernandez was in high school, his father had gone in for a hernia operation, a very kind of like basic, you know, non-dangerous operation, and something went wrong and his dad ended up dying and then he went crazy. And there's a theory homosexuality comes out of a need for a connection with the same sex that you didn't get in your childhood. So the fact that he lost his dad could have predisposed him afterwards to act on that. So one of the things that they found is that when he went into jail, he had transferred a bunch of money to some guy's account, and they believe that that was his boyfriend outside of prison. And then when he was in prison, he had a boyfriend in there, and so that when he had this boyfriend, it was he got very close to this guy, and so he left three suicide notes, and one of them was to his prison boyfriend. So anyway, I thought it was kind of notable, kind of intriguing, interesting, whatever. All right, so here is, I want to just throw out for you the idea that what we're doing in the West is really a continuation of what occurred in the Crusade times, when Islam was created, and it was created around the year 600, basically 610, I think, is when Muhammad had his revelations. I was telling somebody about this last night. Muhammad has these revelations. He then goes, tells his wife, and he says, I think Satan is tormenting me. And she says, no, honey, that's God. And so then he starts talking to his friends and family members, gets a little following, and then he goes around to the town that he was living in and starts telling him that there's only one God. And they feel like, historians believe that he was influenced by the people that he met when he was a kid. He met a lot of people on these, we had talked about the Spice Trail, the Silk Road last week. Well, he had met people on these trading routes in Arabia, and so he was exposed to Christians and Jews and missionaries and such. So he was influenced by all this stuff, one of which was monotheism, whereas the pagan tribes that he was living in, these were Bedouin tribes, and Bedouins live in the desert, and then there were Arabs in the towns. People were obviously polytheists, and Mecca was a huge center of polytheism. It was basically a pilgrimage site, much like it is today, except there were a lot of different religions. And so that was their main source of income, was these pilgrims. And that would be like going to Vegas and saying, God told me that gambling has to be made illegal. I mean, how do you think that would go over? So it didn't go over very well, and they chased him out of town. They tried to kill him. He went to Medina. He went to the Jews and explained that he was their prophet. He was their Messiah. And they said, well, are you from the line of David? And he said, no. And they said, well, are you at least Jewish? And he said, no. And they said, well, they treated him with a lot of scorn and said, you can't be our Messiah, I'm sorry, and kicked him out. And then he went to the Christians. The Christians thought he was insane, mentally ill. But they treated him with more respect and kind of cared for him. And then that is one of the explanations historically why the Jews are, you know, verboten persona non grata in Islam. But the Jews didn't accept him as a Messiah either. But he finally gathered his forces and went back and took over Mecca. When he came back to Medina to settle scores, and he lined up all the Jewish men in the town, something like 800 or 900 men, lined them up and cut all their heads off one after another. So that is a foundation of jihad. You disagree with a prophet, you lose your head. 7:15. Here's a little clip. What are the main beliefs of Islam?
Welcome to the 1 Minute Apologist. 1 Minute Apologist. Apologetics seeks to give credible answers to curious questions, to give a defense. What are the main beliefs of Islam? As Christians, it's important for us to get our hands around what Muslims believe. And a Muslim believes that Allah is the absolute one God. In fact, they'll go so far as to say that Christians have committed the sin of shirk, that is, joining gods to God. And many Muslims think that Christians are tritheists, believing in three gods, whereas we are monotheists who believe in one God, but we believe in one God revealed in three persons, therefore we're Trinitarian. They also believe that the Quran is completely incorruptible. They believe that Muhammad is the ultimate prophet. He is the seal of the prophets it talks about in the Quran. They believe that they are saved by works. And at the end of the time, what Allah will do is he will look at one's deeds, and if their good deeds outweigh their bad deeds, they may have a chance to enter into eternal life. That all falls under Allah's sovereign decree. They also believe in ultimate judgment, heaven, and hell. These are some of the core beliefs that Muslims believe.
He was mistaken on one point. Shirk is to associate anything human or anything on earth, anything created with God. It's not just what he said, which would be kind of a subset of that. And then think of anything else. All right. Well, let's take a little break here and come back and get into a little more on Islam. The Crusades are an outline for what's happening now. And the scary thing is that the West doesn't even know it anymore. The West used to be very aware of what the Muslims believed, and that it was our way or the highway theory, And the Christians are so disjointed and lost, or the Christian, let's say Christian civilization, that they can't even process what's going on, which is an attempt from the Muslims' mind, from the radical jihadists, but also from the typical Muslims moving into Europe and the United States, is they would like to have Sharia law, and they know the only way to do that is to take over. I mean, it's just the history of Islam. I'll tell you a little more about it when we come back. 718 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 523-1450.
I'd like to settle down, but they won't let me. A fugitive must be a rolling stone. Down every road, there's always one more city. I'm on the run, the highway is my home.
All right, so one thing to remember, when Muhammad dies, it's in, I'm trying to remember the date. He gets his revelation in 610, and I think he's dead by 630 A.D., so about 600 years after Christ. And after he is gone, the Muslims go and basically circle what they call the Mare Nostrum, the Mediterranean Sea, and they go throughout the Middle East, and then they go into Turkey, I think it was Anatolia at that point. And then they go down into Africa, and then they come up from Africa and they go into Europe, and the Muslims they go into Spain, and they stay about 700 years. They're in Italy for about 100 years. They go into France, and France is where Charles the Hammer Martel meets them and defeats them at the Battle of Tours-Poitiers. Now, one of the things that I had said to these not figurative, but literal rocket scientists from Europe was that what has happened is that Europe, even though Europe represents the application of Christianity and history in the world from the Christ ministry, obviously, but as the Roman Empire falls and, you know, Europe is peopled by all these tribes and you know, petty kings, and the Christian missionaries come in, and then through leaders like Charlemagne, Europe is converted to Christianity. But now Europe lacks the conviction. It lacks the coherent worldview. So you've got the charity of Christianity. You've got the charity. You've got this, liberalism is kind of maybe the best way to understand liberalism is to understand it as a kind of an agnostic or atheistic offshoot of Christianity, because it takes almost all of the themes, the great themes from the Bible and from the church, and develops its own take on them, which is inevitably atheistic, but it's still got the same basic structure. And so So you've got all of these people in Europe who are not, you know, they're not Muslims, but they're not really Christian in the traditional sense. They're not converted Christian. They're not evangelical. They're cultural Christians. And what they're really fighting for is liberalism, this kind of de-spirited Christianity that turns into liberalism. And they're just sitting ducks. And that's what I'm telling these people. I said, how would you feel about the Muslims coming into Europe and then taking over and asserting their ideas? And one of the guys said, well, I don't see a problem with that. And the reason they don't see a problem is, number one, they don't know what Islam is in terms of its beliefs. But number two, they don't understand how drastically everything would change. And one of the things that is kind of symptomatic of Islam, and I've got a book on this, the doctrine of, basically the title in so many words, the doctrine of the accepted and the unacceptable. And in the West, we have the freedom to do everything that is not illegal. In Islam, they can only do what is prescribed, which is a totally different worldview, which would explain why their culture is not as creative. All right, here's a little more on Islamic beliefs and practices.
Today we're going to discuss Islamic beliefs and practices. Islamic beliefs come from the Quran, which is the holy book of Islam. The Quran contains all of the messages that the angel Gabriel gave to Muhammad. And as you probably remember, the angel Gabriel was giving Muhammad the word of God. So only the word of God has gone into the Quran, according to Muslim tradition. In the Quran, you can find information about Muslim beliefs, such as there being only one God and Muhammad being his prophet. It also does things like encourage Muslims to free their slaves, because back during the time of Muhammad, slavery was a common practice. It forbids drinking of alcohol, eating pork. It also gives women the right to education, to own property, to earn money. And these are all things that we might take for granted today in our society, but they were not common in Arab society in Muhammad's time. Another important book in Islam is the Sunnah. The Sunnah is a book that gives Muslims guidelines on how to live their lives the way Muhammad lived his. The Sunnah is based on the Hadith, which was a written record that was made by Muhammad's followers that recorded Muhammad's words and deeds. So one of the important things that is in the Sunnah is the five pillars of Islam. These are the five things that every Muslim is supposed to try to do in his or her lifetime. So number one, the first pillar is that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. The second pillar encourages Muslims to pray five times a day and sets out kind of the practices for those prayers. The third pillar is to give alms or charity to the poor. The fourth is to fast during the month of Ramadan. Now, Ramadan is an entire lunar month, so the fasting in this case does not take place for the entire month. Instead, it takes place during all daylight hours. So that would be from sunrise to sunset every day for the lunar month of Ramadan. Muslims do not eat or drink anything, and that includes water. And number five is Hajj, which is pilgrimage. Each Muslim is supposed to make a pilgrimage to Mecca at some point in his or her lifetime. Now, there are some exceptions that are made for people who are either sick or too poor to travel, or too young, too old. None of these things are supposed to create such a big burden on a person that they threaten the person's health or well-being. So, for example, young children do not fast during Ramadan, neither do the elderly. The Hajj, again, if you can't afford a trip to Mecca, you're sort of excused from that one, but you're supposed to try to do it if you can. So that's a little bit about the five pillars. Now, another term that is important in Islam is Sharia. Sharia means Islamic law. Now, here in our society, we have a pretty lengthy tradition of not mingling religious ideas with our laws. We have a pretty strict separation of church and state in the United States. And in many other countries, that is also the case. But in a lot of Muslim countries, they do use a lot of Islamic influences when making their laws. So Sharia is based on interpretations of the Quran and the Sunnah together, and those interpretations vary from place to place, country to country, but in Muslim countries, it is very common for Sharia to be the basis for at least some laws, and in some cases today, Sharia may be the basis for the entire legal code in a Muslim country.
All right, so Sharia doesn't mean law. It means the path. It means the path to the watering hole. That's the original definition. 6:30, we'll take a little break here for some local news and come back and talk about the Crusades. Just wanted to remind you what it is Muslims believe, 7:30. And, you know, they also obviously believe to some extent, if you kill a non-believer, you're doing the work of God, which is a very scary idea. 7:30 a.m. Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. We'll be back. All right, here's a little brief outline of the Crusades. The Crusades began when there were reports coming back to Europe that Christians were being slaughtered in, basically, in Jerusalem, Israel. And so that's what kicked it off. It is very common to be told today that the West was the one that was at odds with law, or, you know, that the West was in the wrong, basically, in the history of Crusades. But if you go back and read it, there's a number of historians who say this is simply not true. The West was reacting to the slaughter of the, basically, of the innocents in Jerusalem. Check this out. This is from a website called Real Crusade History in YouTube.
The Crusades were military campaigns waged by Western European Christians during the Middle Ages for the defense and expansion of Christendom. What made a crusade distinct was that warriors involved in the fighting received spiritual merit, usually a plenary indulgence granted by the Pope. A crusade was considered by Western European Christians to be a holy act, an act of sacrifice and piety for the love of Christ. 4 centuries before the beginning of the Crusades, the first Muslim army swept out of Arabia to conquer Palestine, Syria, Mesopotamia, Egypt, North Africa, and Spain, some 2/3 of the Christian world. Between the 7th and 11th centuries, Christians fought wars against Muslims to prevent them from making further conquests into Christian territory, or to reconquer what had already been captured. In Spain, Christian kingdoms waged wars to recapture their homeland from the Arabs, while the Byzantine Empire in the east was engaged in centuries of war with the Muslims for control of Anatolia and other regions. In the 11th century, the Seljuk Turks, recent converts to Islam, swept through Syria and Palestine. In 1071, they defeated the Byzantines at the Battle of Manzikert, conquering almost all of Anatolia. In response, Pope Urban II called the First Crusade, asking knights from all over Europe to band together and push back the Seljuks. Over the 12th and 13th centuries, the popes called more crusades to the Holy Land and also called for crusades in Spain to help push back the Muslim powers. Crusades against Muslims were not called with the intention of converting them to Christianity. Rather, they were called to regain control of territory that had been previously Christian, but had fallen to Muslim armies. Jerusalem had been conquered by the Muslims in 637 and was considered particularly important to Western Christians, since it was the site of Christ's crucifixion. Indeed, Jerusalem was revered as the holiest site in the Christian cosmos, and it was particularly important to Western Europeans that it be brought again under Christian rule. When, in the 11th century, news arrived that Christian pilgrims traveling to Jerusalem were being harassed and killed by the Seljuk Turks, this fact alone inspired many knights to join the First Crusade. Although the Crusades were called to reclaim lands, greed was not a primary motivation. Professor Jonathan Riley Smith, the world's foremost expert on Crusades history, has proven that crusading was incredibly dangerous and expensive, and that virtually none of the knights who went could expect to gain wealth. Indeed, they often bankrupted themselves crusading. The primary motivation for crusading was spiritual, with the knights joining because they believed that they were doing God's work by fighting to protect Christian pilgrims and to reclaim holy sites like Jerusalem, and that involving themselves in a crusade would win them spiritual merit. The Crusades to the Holy Land saw many failures, but also many successes. The First Crusade and the Third Crusade, for example, were both very successful, though ultimately later, at the close of the 13th century, the last Crusader holdings in Syria and Palestine would be captured by the Muslim Mamluk Empire. However, the Crusades in Spain achieved lasting victory, with the whole of Spain being ultimately recaptured by the Christians. Later Crusades would also be called against the Ottoman Turks, such as the Crusade of Lepanto in 1571. If you want to learn more about the Crusades, subscribe to this channel, Real Crusades History.
All right, so that is something that's basically, if you want to, well, actually, there appears to be a little left here. Hold on.
Watching my new book.
All right, so keep in mind that the purpose of the moving out from Mecca and Medina of the Muslims and taking over the world of that time between the Middle East and Northern Africa and then into Europe happened in about 100 years, and it happened by way of the sword. And there was a clever way that they did it, put everybody to the sword. Necessarily what they would do is take the country over, take the area over, and just say, you know, you don't have to believe in Islam, but if you don't believe in Islam, you have to pay a tax, which is called the jizya, which was then applied and was one of the things that was very persuasive to people who were living under it for obvious reasons. Now, to this day, Northern Africa is still Muslim. So now it took the Christians about very much 1,000 years to take over the Europe because they had done it through persuasion as opposed to violence. Although Charlemagne, the great king, was also a person who converted kings by sword at that time. We'll take a break, 7:41, and come back and talk a little bit about the Battle of Tours-Poitiers, which was one of the most decisive battles in history and stopped the Muslims from coming any further into Europe. 523-1450, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, talking about the Crusades and Islam and history with the West. All right, so then you've got the Battle of Tours-Poitiers, which sets the foundation for Charlemagne. I believe it's Charles Martel, the Hammer, and then Pepin the Short, and then Charles the Third, which is Charlemagne. And if Martel doesn't stop the Muslims at Tours Portier 732-733, then Europe is taken over by the Muslims. So check this out.
600 years.
And we're still dealing with this today, the Muslims attempting to take over France through violence.
After Christ's crucifixion, his church had become the dominant cultural force in Europe. But while his disciples were flocking to monasteries in search of solitude, further east, the followers of another prophet were taking up arms in search of conquest. On the dusty shores of North Africa and Arabia, mighty armies were waging war, not in the name of Christ, but of the Quran. Their religious movement would spread even farther and faster than Christianity and threaten to compete for the souls of Europe. The only thing standing in their way was one Christian king who had seen them coming. October 10, 732 AD. Tours, France is on the front line in a holy war that will define Europe's spiritual and political future. The conflict pits the Christian Franks against the Muslim Moors, who had recently crossed into Spain from North Africa. The Moors want to expand their empire and import their faith in Mohammed, the prophet of Islam who lived a century earlier. The Christians want to keep them out at all costs.
They saw it as an immediate and local threat to themselves. The Muslims believed that they were there to rule over the earth and bring about God's justice and institute God's order. And so in that sense, there might have been what you could call a religious mission to the conquest.
The Moors saw Europe as easy prey, a land defended by barbarians who were too busy fighting each other to fight anyone else. In 730, Moorish General Abdul Rahman al-Ghafiqi crossed into France with an army of 50,000 men. At the head of the charge was an elite division of cavalry, unmatched in Europe.
The Moorish armies in Gaul moved very, very fast, and they were considerably more maneuverable than the Frankish army, and they could hit and run in a way that a large Frankish host simply could not.
The Moors tore through southern France with terrifying tenacity, devastating the regions of Aquitaine and Gascony, and leaving a legion of enemy dead behind at the Battle of the River Garonne. One Moorish fighter wrote that his army went through all places like a desolating storm. Christian chronicler lamented that God alone knows the number of the slain. After relieving the local monasteries of all their riches, the Moors turned northward, confident they could conquer all of France. But there, the commander of the Frankish army stood guard, waiting patiently for the enemy to strike. And when it did, he would be ready.
Now, does he think he can win? Don't know. He has to win because there's no other answer. The Islamic forces will continue to attack and continue to fill France with Islam unless he defends.
The general's name was Charles the Hammer Martel. As commander-in-chief of the Frankish army, Martel would anticipate the unique threat posed by the Moorish invasion and take proactive steps to confront it head-on. But to do so, he would first have to convince his own countrymen to trade their plowshares for swords. In Dark Ages Europe, most troops were farmers who were only available to fight between the spring planting and the fall harvest. But Charles Martel understood that the Moorish threat couldn't be met without a well-oiled group of professional, full-time soldiers at his disposal.
He knew he was at a disadvantage. What's the basis of every successful army? Money. To get the money, he had to go to the church. This was not a popular move with the church, and Charles came very close to being excommunicated, that is to say, being damned to hell for eternity. The church pulled back at just the last minute. Charles took land and property from the church and used it to finance the development of an army that could be trained to withstand this formidable force.
While Charles the Hammer pounded courage into his corps, Abdul Rahman maintained his march northward into the realm of an enemy he had severely underrated.
The perception of the Franks as warriors was not particularly impressive. Abdul Rahman may not have been paying as close attention to Charles Martel as he probably needed to in this case. He may not have at all been prepared for the kind of force he was going to meet.
The Franks dug in on a high wooded ridge that offered a critical strategic advantage. When the Moors arrived, they were stunned to find such a formidable force awaiting them. For 6 days, the two armies stood firm, waiting for the other to make the first move. But as the October cold set in, Moorish General Abdul Rahman knew he had to move quickly if he wanted to take Tours before winter. So on the seventh day, he ordered attack.
Charles Martel's infantry is great, and they stand like a wall. That is what the sources on the Muslim side say. That is what the sources on the Christian side say.
While his infantry kept the Moors occupied, Charles the Hammer nailed down his victory with a covert mission behind enemy lines. Charles had sent some troops to the Muslim camp. That is to say, an encampment behind the line of battle where this incredibly successful Muslim army had kept all of the plunder that they had obtained in their successful campaign. This was cutting off the head of the snake from the perspective of Charles and his troops.
That encouraged people to retreat from the front lines to the tents, and it convinced a lot of people that a general retreat was being called.
General Abdul Rahman tried to rally his fleeing forces, but as he screamed out orders to stand and fight, he was surrounded and struck down by enemy infantry. Overnight, the Moors withdrew and made a beeline south for Spain. It was his stunning victory at the Battle of Tours that earned Martel the nickname Charles the Hammer. At a time when many parts of the old Roman and Persian empires were falling under Muslim rule, Charles was credited as the savior of Christianity in Europe.
He had some really good PR. Charles Martel was quick to stand up and basically say, look what I just did. I'm the defender of Christendom, and I helped turn back these forces that threatened us.
Over the next seven decades, Martel's descendants would transform his Christian kingdom into an empire, and one of them would even become powerful enough to assume the title Emperor of Rome. That grandson of Charles the Hammer would be remembered as the father of Europe. His name was Charlemagne, and he was the greatest king of the Dark Ages.
All right, so that's where we came from. That's our story. Now we're turning our back on defending Europe and defending America because we're totally ignorant of our history. 7:54, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces. We'll be back to finish her up.
I'm lonely. I can't afford the luxury of having one I love come along.
All right, so a little bit of history, and I mean, I don't know what else to say other than if we remember the history that we came from, if we remember why things were done and what our forebears, the forefathers and foremothers believed, then I think we have a chance of making it. If not, I don't. Here's something from Dan St. Germain. I used to be a security guard.
Stand up. I used to fight crime. I was a crime fighter. I checked ladies' purses before they entered an art museum. And for a full year, I was put in front of this art museum checking purses. Then out of nowhere, my boss throws me in the back. He doesn't give me an answer why until I find out, I swear to God, this is completely true, that First Lady Michelle Obama was coming to visit, and they were nervous that I personally was going to make a bad impression. I swear to God. I was like, what did they think I was going to do when I saw Michelle Obama? Like, Michelle Obama! Michelle! Michelle Obama! Please sign my Michelle Obama action figure. It's actually just Storm from the X-Men, but I threw a pantsuit on her. And then, I started working overnight security because I thought I'd be able to write more. You know, but when you, like, work overnight security, what you write about changes, you know? So instead of, like, fun things that happened to me at the grocery store, it was a lot of, have you ever been talking to the owl? You know, the owl you talk to. And you realize halfway through it's just a bunch of hats in the shape of an owl. Hey, what's funnier, pissing your pants or crying at the same time?